All right. Well, welcome to episode 41 of the Perigee Podcast. I'm your host, Chief Mass Sergeant of the Space Force, B-9 Bentivania. And today I have a very special guest and very special episode. Sitting across from me is our own, very own CSO, General Saltzman. Sir, thanks very much for joining us today.
Proud to be here.
Yeah. You know, I haven't seen you in a while. I've been traveling and you were on leave.
Traveling? Is that what you're doing? Because I kept getting these pictures and text messages.
Sir, of you
connecting
with Guardians. Connecting with Guardians was all about. They're doing amazing things around the world. Yeah. How was leave? You just came back,
good.
Right?
Yeah. We got to get the house ready because we have a whole space house full of stuff that has to fall in on our retirement house. And I don't think it's going to fit.
Well, you need, I think, 3 trucks just for the Christmas stuff, the decorations alone, I think.
Oh, if it was only 3 trucks. If it was only 3 trucks.
Yeah. I'm glad you were doing it in my office because, you know, through the years, I don't know you've had a chance to come over here quite often.
I come over when you're not here, rifle through all your stuff.
Is that why I'm always missing stuff?
So you're always missing stuff. All right. That's right.
To the team, let's make sure we change the locks, please, so we can do that. But no, seriously, sir, thanks for coming over.
Happy to be here.
And, you know, I was thinking, Nine days away.
Right? 9 days.
About 9 days from retirement.
That's exactly right.
So you ready?
No. I mean, in the one hand, I'm ready because 35 years is a long time to do this. I think for those that have done it that long, it does. It takes a lot of time and energy and to get to 35 years. Proud of that. But I'm also proud that we've got the Space Force in a position to keep going, keep moving. And so I'm kind of excited to hand the reins off, get fresh eyes on the problems. Yeah. I think that's healthy for the organization. So I'm proud of where we are, but also proud to hand it off to the next generation.
Did you ever imagine this? Like, did you imagine that, you know, when it came time for you to step away, like we all have to do, take off the uniform, that you'd be doing it as the CSO?
Well, absolutely.
Or as the chief of a service?
I mean, of course, yeah. You know, when I was a cadet, I was like, I'm going to be the chief of a service.
Yeah, I think that's on some of your older OPRs somewhere.
That's right. No, I honestly, one, the easy answer is there's no way to have envisioned this because the service didn't exist. The job that I'm in doesn't exist. The job you're in didn't exist way back then. So it was hard to say that I could have seen myself in this. You know, I thought after I'd been in 5, 6, 7 years that, hey, I can get to 20 years. I could probably get to a retirement. You know, if I could be a squadron commander and get to retirement, how awesome would that be? Yeah. That was probably about it. Everything else after that felt like bonus time.
Yeah.
Bonus. So, no, I never even thought I'd be here.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, one of the things that you've really stressed is, and I think it reflects in the officer career pyramid that, like we said, squadron commander is kind of where that's kind of the pinnacle, right? That's, you know, even when I spent my time as a squadron superintendent, that's where the rubber meets the road. And that's where all the tactical, right, all the good stuff happens. And to think that back when you said, what are your aspirations, squadron commander?
Yeah.
And it's coming full circle.
You know, even, I hate to admit it, that was 20 years ago that I got squadron command. And I think it's still true with that retrospective hindsight. It's the greatest unit of the military.
Yeah.
That, and to be the 05 commander of that, it's the one job I feel like I had where I was directly responsible for people and mission. It kind of all comes together right there. You know, there, in subsequent jobs, I had mission responsibilities, but weren't as tightly connected to the people doing the mission. And so it all comes together right there. And that's why the career pyramid does kind of end there, you know, superintendent, master sergeant, squadron commander, because that's the pinnacle, I think.
Yeah. So when you look back now, you know, 35 years, did it go by fast?
There were days that were really long. I say that all the time. There's days that are long. There's even some weeks that were long. But yes, when you look back, I still feel like a captain trying to figure out how to file a travel voucher, you know? So it does go pretty quick.
Do you do your own travel vouchers? I don't.
I said when I was a captain.
Okay.
I am not qualified.
Neither am I. Yeah. You know, it's funny that I get comments made to me. Sometimes I'll come in and I'll open up the door here in the Pentagon and I'll be doing the dial by myself. And someone will walk by and say, Chief, they actually let you open your own. Like, you know how to do that? I'm like, Yeah, of course.
It's muscle memory.
That's right.
Dialing combos, but
that's right.
You know, when we got in, there was a MPF, and you filed your own travel vouchers. Mm-hmm. You filled out paper leave forms.
Holy Joe.
Yeah, it feels like we really have become more of a digital service, a digital department than certainly the analog times when we grew up.
That's right. That's right. As long as the website's up and running, you can get into it.
As long as the system is working, you're up and running. Yeah.
Sir, you know, when you were, when the president nominated you to become the next CSO, and then, you know, what your thoughts were, and then when you actually got into the seat, was it what you were expecting? I mean, was there, you know, in your head thinking about what it would be like to lead a service and then actually do it?
No, it's hard to put into words. I've been thinking about this as I get towards the end and actually trying to help CSO3 get his mind around what this is going to look like. And it is difficult because until you're in the seat, until people are looking to you to make a decision or provide guidance or evaluate a policy, and you know the buck has to stop with you, there's really nobody left to turn to, you have to make a decision. It gets real fast.
Yeah.
It gets real very fast. And so I feel like I was as prepared as you could be for it. I've been in the Pentagon for almost 10 years straight now, with the exception of a deployment. I've watched service chiefs up close and personal for years now. So I knew what I was getting into to a degree.
Yeah.
But until that burden is on your shoulders, it's hard to really put into words exactly what the responsibility feels like.
Yeah. Well, you did an amazing job.
Thank you.
At it. So, you know, sir,
I had a lot of help.
We all do. We all have a team. And you know, that's one of the things I think that you and I talk often about is, you know, all the advantages of having a small service, right? That connection, that relationship that we have with one another, and be able really as a tight-knit group of guardians to get after the hard problem sets that we have. And you and I have had opportunities when we do go out and travel and we get a chance to engage with guardians. And you think about, you know, it's a room full of people, but it's a large percentage of the entire force. And I think when I talk to my counterparts, some of them are a little jealous of the fact that we're able to have that type of relationship and work so closely together because of the advantage we have as a small. There's some disadvantages we have, but that is definitely one of the strengths that we have.
I agree, Binan. I think capacity in the military services is something that's noteworthy. If you don't have the capacity to do your basic missions and functions, then you better be paying attention and trying to figure out how to get those resources or come up with a different way of doing business. But we would be remiss if we didn't recognize that there are advantages to being small.
Yes.
That there are, you know, advantages to only being three layers removed from most senior leadership to most junior guardian on crew, right? Yeah. And so I think we just need to keep reminding ourselves that, yes, capacity, you know, can be a problem sometimes, but boy, it's an advantage, and we should not go on the assumption that we can't do things.
Yes.
Rather, what can we do because we're small? How fast can we go with this?
You know, you and I spoke about with the size of the service and taking advantage of that and then communicating intent, communicating messaging. And, you know, in your head, you came up with a process, a way that you wanted to talk directly to guardians, to spur a conversation. So we actually have a couple of props that they're going to show. So for those of you who are only listening, I'm going to show General Saltzman here. It's a photograph. And sir, if you could just maybe talk a little bit about what that photograph is.
Yeah, this is pretty cool. When I got the job, I started thinking about not just what's my vision, not just what are the priorities, where do I think the Space Force needs to go, but how do I get everybody to feel like they're a part of that journey? How do I involve them so they see themselves as not being a member of the Space Force, but actually being the Space Force, being that connected to it? And I knew that we had such a talent pool of guardians and some really smart people out there. And I wanted to make sure they were debating the same issues that I was going to have to struggle with and debate. And of course, you get this mantle of leadership thrust upon you and you start going, all right, well, who's done this well in the past? And I started looking up some of the old service chiefs and I ran across Admiral Zumwalt, who was the CNO, Chief of Naval Operations, back in the 70s. And pretty tumultuous time that he was dealing with coming out of the Vietnam War. And there was a lot of things going on in terms of females in the ranks and some of the racial issues that were going on. And he knew that he couldn't solve all those issues without buy-in from the lowest levels throughout the fleet. And so he started, he had Z-grams. Yeah. And I'm fully acknowledging that I stole that idea from Admiral Zumwalt.
Borrowed it.
Yeah. His Z-grams was a direct communication out to the fleet. And he wanted to make sure that they understood what he was thinking about some of the key issues, and he could challenge them, and he could. And I read some of them, and they were just, it was inspiring that he was willing to have that as direct a conversation as you could in the 70s with the communication, what it was. And so I stole it, and I thought, a CSO notice, you know, then I got really clever and became a C-note, right, was a way to do that.
Yeah.
And so I found this picture that I'm looking at here. It's Admiral Zumwalt on one of his ships, I think, in the galley. You can tell because of the red and white checkered tablecloth that's on it there. But he's got a lot of sailors around him, and they're kind of, you can tell it's an interaction. You can tell he's listening and talking. Yeah. They're engaged. They're leaning forward to hear what's being said. Yeah. And some sailor is saying, this is what the issue is, and he's pushing back on him. And that picture was inspiring. It was about having an open dialogue and trying to have it with the masses.
Yeah.
And so that was the kind of the inspiration behind the C-notes. And the picture of me is just a similar situation in Colorado Springs, where I had an opportunity to hear some firsthand feedback from Guardians. And I was trying to explain to them what I thought was the rationale behind a decision. And they were pushing back and telling me what they thought. And the pictures kind of look similar. So.
Well, sir, in the photograph of you with the Guardians, they're having that discussion. And you're civilian clothes, right? Someplace just casually, you know, having a Guardian to Guardian conversation. You're writing on something. Do you know, what are you writing on there?
I'm pretty sure it's whatever I could grab, which was probably like a paper plate or a napkin or something. You know, it's not important what the medium is where you convey these ideas. You have to grab what is at your disposal and sketch it out so people can see in real time that what your thought process is. Yeah. So I think I grabbed a napkin or a paper plate or something, and I sketched out what we were talking about.
I think most of the individuals there are weapons school grads. I think they're all patches that you're having that conversation. And you know, they were so inspired, I think, by that opportunity to engage with you that the medium you did choose to kind of run and have the conversation, they kept it. And
what?
They actually kept it. And it was, we borrowed this. It came through security. It was locked up, but it's a framed paper plate. That you were talking to them about.
That's pretty cool.
And they kept that. And they let us borrow that because they said, hey, we're going to talk about this on the podcast.
Well, I was right. It was a paper plate.
Yeah.
I knew it was something like that. Not my best artwork, I can tell you. I've probably been more descriptive
and a
little better.
I've seen some of your stick figures, sir. Yeah.
That's about right.
Yeah.
But I'm proud there's no grease on here. I don't see any spaghetti sauce or pizza sauce or anything like that on there. So at least
And that is the actual artifact. That is not a reproduction.
That's right. Well, I recognize it because I know exactly what I was talking about. The three quadrant problem of space superiority and I liked that I said, get it done.
Yes.
Right. Because I think that's ultimately what it was. I think we got to the point where we were saying, okay, this is a hard problem, but how do we solve it? I said, well, I don't know what all the issues are that have to be addressed here. I don't know what all the tasks are here.
Yeah.
You just got to go get it done. Like, take this on and make it happen. So that was a good night.
Well, it's great. I mean, sir, obviously, you know, your intent was taken because, you know, it was something they realized a moment was happening. And they decided to kind of keep and go forward with it.
Cool.
So the C-notes have been, I think, really successful. I mean, on the road, you and I have had opportunities to engage, and it's a point of departure for discussion with Guardians when we're out and about, and they've been great. And the last three, I think, that you've put out were kind of reflective of the lines of effort that you initially, you know, brought to the service. And I think, you know, your assessment of kind of where we are and how successful we've been and what do we have to do next. So if it was okay with you, I just wanted to kind of talk about a little bit about the last couple of C-notes that you put out on the lines of effort. So the first one you put out was for fielding combat-ready forces. And you talk about we're presenting resilient, ready, and combat-credible space forces to the joint force also requires the right equipment, training and support structure and that journey we're on. So, you know, sir, where do you think we are today, and what's the next thing that the part of that journey we have to do?
Well, let's start with the bottom line up front. Guardians in the field are killing it.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, sometimes that's literal.
Yes.
Epic Fury, you don't have to look further than that to see that Guardians are directly in the fight, directly contributing. I tell people all the time that what's maybe not known is that Space Force elements were Men Force package, meaning you are go, no go.
Yeah.
The commander is going to make a decision by seeing if there's a Men Force package in place. And when Guardians and their force elements are a part of that Men Force package, you know you are integral to the fight.
Yeah.
You can't do that if you're not combat ready.
Yes.
You can't do that if you're not credible, if you haven't instilled confidence, if the planners haven't put it together, if the guidance and orders aren't out there, if the training's not complete, if they're not deployed and secure in their place and done all the work that needs to be done in the run-up, you know, the prep of the battle space, they say. All that has to be done. It has to be done at an expert level to give confidence to the commanders that they're ready to execute. So bottom line up front, I know we're combat credible because we're executing combat operations effectively. But I also say there's a lot of work to be done.
Yes.
And that's why I focus on the processes. I focus on what it takes to be combat credible. Are we giving the Guardians the tools, the reps and sets, the time? That's where we got the force generation model, to carve out time and capacity, quite frankly. Because our day-to-day operations aren't necessarily equivalent to a high-end fight. So we have to come out of that rotation, come out of that commit phase, and then dedicate our times to practicing what it would mean to be in a high-end fight. We're still trying to get better at building simulators and range environments that replicate a threat so you can go against the thinking adversary and get better and better. But I think we've come a long way, and I think the foundations are in place now, and I think we do have a combat credible force.
You know, you and I spent a lot of time advocating and really bragging on Guardians. But I think some of the strongest advocates we have, to your point, like when Admiral Cooper, you know, talks about Space Force and Guardians and what they're doing for him and his AOR, and when the chairman during his press conferences specifically calls out the Space Force, I was really happy and proud when I got a chance to talk to the chairman when he was talking to all the SCAs. I thanked him for that. And I says, you are right. You were amplifying the Guardian spirit. You are acknowledging, right, the fact that we were working really hard as part of the joint force to, you know, underpin the lethality, but also to protect and defend the overall joint force, right, from our adversary's capabilities. And I think that's, you know, when you talk about, have we been able to deliver combat credible forces? So I think, right, those are just two examples. 100%.
You know, and even when we were most successful way back in the day, we were still behind the green door. We were behind closed doors.
Yes.
So if you knew, you knew, but not very many people knew. The world's not that simple anymore. We're not just the icing on the cake that makes things a little better. We're the eggs in the batter. Like, you know, the combatant commander recognizes that without what space offers in terms of its capabilities and effects, the rest of the joint force doesn't succeed. And that's just front and center. It's on everybody's mind. And so it doesn't surprise me that Admiral Cooper and Chairman Kane, they just get it because it's so obvious.
Yeah, I think that great advocates and acknowledging what we're doing as a service and the Guardians to take care of business. One of the things also that you said in the C-note, which is C-note 39 on fielding combat credible forces, is the most dangerous thing we can do is rest on the status quo. And you've said that to us in staff meetings, and you've said that phrase a few times. So I just wanted to kind of pick at that a little bit on, you know, when you say that, kind of walk us through what's in your head. What's the warning to the service?
I think about it in two ways. One, There's a certain comfort that comes with the way we've done business. And that's what I mean when I say status quo, kind of the way we're currently doing business, the way things work. That's the status quo. And you get to that point and you retire all the risk associated with it. There's no risk with what we're doing today. Now, we know that's not true, but in our minds, we start to think that if we do something different, there's risk. If we move in a different direction or if we innovate away from our current procedure, there's going to be risk that we'll have to address. Yeah. And you don't recognize that by staying in your status quo, the world is changing around you. The threat environment is changing around you. Other capabilities are changing around you. That is adding risk to your current operations. So there's this inherent risk that's accumulating around the status quo that we almost ignore.
Yeah.
And if you sit back idly and say status quo works, you are setting yourself up for failure. So I think that's the most important thing to recognize, is that status quo is buying risk because the world is changing around it. And then the second is, you know, this idea that change, it's hard. It's going to take extra effort, and you're comfortable with status quo. And if we're going to do something different, then I've got to change my thought process. I may not be as good as what you're proposing. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain amount of courage that's required to move forward. But if we don't recognize that that which is good today will not be good forever, and that we have to continue to change as the environment changes, that's the only way to succeed, then we're setting ourselves up for risk that we can't afford. And so that's why I just keep pushing. Hey, what's next? Like, we got to keep moving forward, or we're not going to be successful.
You know, you also, in the same scene, you know, talked about the future operating environment that you put out, and you said, hey, again, right, this was to drive that discussion on where are we going, right? We know that it's continued to evolve, not that it's an end state, but you kind of threw it down as a challenge, like challenge the assumptions that we're making, challenge the direction that we're going. And it's been out for a few months now. So I was curious, you know, has it sparked debate? Have you been out and about? Have you had, you know, thinkers come back to you, guardians, and challenge or question what's been in the future operating environment?
Absolutely. And so it's successful by all definitions that I had going into it.
Good.
Challenge what you have written down. I think maybe to step back a little bit, it takes courage to say, this is what I think. Mm-hmm. And I say this
for all the world to see.
Right. And when you take the time to write it down, then what you're saying is, I have the courage not only to say what I'm thinking, but to write it down so you can keep revisiting it. And you can say, well, you can argue with me, but this is what you wrote down. Here you are, you know, telling me what I wrote in C-note, right?
That's right.
Yeah, I wrote it down because I want you to critique it. I want you to debate it. It's the only way we can move forward. And the future operating environment is to drive that debate. There's no way we can say with 100% accuracy we know what the future is going to look like 15 years from now.
Yeah.
That's not the point. The point is, we start to guess. We start to make an educated guess based on everything we can imagine, trend analysis, data, what we're seeing. Industry, other nations, and the threat, and then document it. Say, hey, here's what a future could look like. Are we ready for this? And then I got challenges. Hey, you forgot about this part, or I think you overemphasized this, or what about cislunar? You don't cover that enough. Oh, valid.
Yeah.
So let's prioritize. Let's figure out what needs to be corrected and get it better the next time we take a look at it.
Yeah, I think it was just a few weeks after I think you released the documents, I was TDY in Colorado Springs, and I had a young weapons officer, who was a major at the time, pull me aside and say, hey, you know, I read that. I think you're wrong on electronic warfare and the kind of direction you're going. And I took a picture with him. I was so happy. I said, I got to send this to the CSO, right? This is exactly, right, what the type of culture, the type of discussion that we wanted to have.
I would be scared to death if you were sending me texts from the field saying everybody agrees 100% with what's in there, I would be scared to death because that means they're not thinking, right? That just means they're taking whatever leadership produces and saying, this is good enough. And I'm so happy that we have critical thinkers in our ranks that are willing to challenge and go, hey, what about this or what about that? That's going to make us better.
Well, speaking about those attributes, in the second C-note in this series that you put out for line of effort number two was amplifying the guardian spirit. And for me personally, as much as, right, that the whole reason that we were established as a service, right, was space superiority, space control, and it's a warfighting aspect of it. But the amplifying the guardian, building the guardian has, for me personally, has been one of the most fun, rewarding things that I think we've had a chance to do the last couple of years. So in your C-note, you used a phrase talking about the guardian DNA, which I thought was really cool. Could you describe it as, you know, the intellect, the initiative, and the adaptability, which is part of the Guardian DNA. How have you seen that evolve as you've been talking about amplifying the Guardian spirit and, you know, where we were, you know, four years ago to where we are today?
Well, first of all, I didn't write that on day one of my journey as CSO. Yeah. But I did come up with the idea of amplifying the guardian spirit pretty early. And so the idea originally was, hey, I just get this sense, you know, from my time as the S3, the chief operating officer at the time, this sense that people are excited about joining a new service. Yeah. People are excited about the idea that the threat that they know is real is being taken seriously, that they're going to, they're they have a national responsibility to address this threat and protect something as vital as our space capability. Yeah. Like you just could sense it. And so the word amplify is what kind of jumped out at me is like, I don't know why they have that feeling. Honestly, I mean, I could say, well, because there's a new service, but you know, but what makes one person have that feeling and another not? I couldn't put my finger on it. But whatever it was, I want more of it.
Yeah.
Like, I just want to amplify. I just want to turn that up, turn that dial up, because that's valuable and I know it's going to be awesome. And so amplify the guardian spirit was a little bit of an idea rather than something tangible that I could sink my teeth into. And then I started going around the units.
Yeah.
And it really started becoming real. And that's when these attributes of what the guardian spirit, that's when the DNA, hey, they're problem solvers. Mm-hmm. They're looking to the future. They're evaluating things, saying, how could this be better? They're questioning assumptions. They're questioning me. How dare they, right? They're saying, I don't know that you got this right. You're not thinking through this. I love it. So just the idea that they took ownership of the problems they were facing and were willing to dive in no matter what it took to try to solve those problems started to make it real. And that's this idea of the guardian spirit became more characteristic of what a guardian was.
You know, in that line of effort, one of the things that you put in place for us, and I think it's one of the things you really love, is the guardian field form. I do love that. And, I, you know, to your point about bringing in problem solvers, so, you know, so you've hosted, right, a few. You've got a chance to kind of hear from the guardians on the guardian field form. You know, from what – and I remember you on the whiteboard in the office saying, be nine, like, this is what we got to do. So from that, you know, nascent in the beginning on the whiteboard to the experience you've had the last couple of years, want to reflect a little bit on the guardian field forms?
Yeah, there's lots of those paper plates laying around.
Yeah.
Some of them are on whiteboards and some of them are on napkins and some of them are actually on paper plates, but there's lots of ideas. And I do think the guardian field form is one of those that it captured two sides of an equation that I thought was important. One is this recognition that the guardians in the field have something to offer. They really, they're the ones that experience the problems firsthand. They want to be a part of fixing them, and they've got good ideas. And then on the other side, there's this ivory tower we call the Pentagon, where you've got these senior leaders who have all the authorities in the world, but quite frankly, we're a little far removed from the day-to-day problems of the field. And so that's great. You got problem people that can solve the problems in the headquarters and people that are experiencing the problems firsthand out in the field. How do you get them together? And so this idea of identifying our best and brightest, bringing them to the Pentagon, do a little professional development, but really have this conversation. What in the field do we need to be thinking about? What is it? What are the problems that we need to tackle? And what are your ideas? And then that interaction back and forth with the senior leaders and the junior guardians has just been uplifting.
Yeah.
And it really does feel like the guardian spirit when you're in the room watching that back and forth happen.
Yeah, you know, the team's always reminding me that the phrase they use is touch grass.
Yeah.
Right? You got to touch grass to go back because being in the Pentagon, there are obviously there are important things that we're doing.
Yep.
But trying to get from the actual, you know, on the ground in the operations floors, in the classrooms, what is actually happening day to day is really important.
You know, one way to say that, Benign, whatever we do in the Pentagon is going to be important. So we better be doing the important things from the field.
That's true.
That's the key.
That's true.
Because we're going to write policy and we're going to resource things and we're going to set priorities. We need it to be grounded in what's actually happening out there in the field.
And it was interesting to me on several of the initiatives that we last couple of years were briefed on by the Guardian Field Forum teams were like initiatives or things that we were worried about in the building that we were trying to solve and address. So to your point about, you know, bringing these subject matter experts, these tactical level leaders together, but they're thinking about how do we grow and evolve the service, right? Yeah. They weren't small, right, focused things. They were broader things because they're, like you said before, they're invested, right? They're not part of not a member of the Space Force. They are the Space Force. And I always thought that was really eye-opening to me when you talk about the amount of talent that we have. That, man, they're thinking the same kind of problem sets that we're trying to address.
Exactly.
So yeah, I definitely enjoyed it all. I think that was great. The other little more physical on the side is Guardian Arena, which was another kind of born out of amplifying a Guardian spirit. And I think that has been another huge success, right? Where you said, where do we bring Guardians together? Where, you know, bring that warfighter ethos, where we're going to challenge them physically, cognitively, right? They tactical problems, got to work together as a team. And you and I, again, have had a chance to see that evolve over the next last several years. And we were just talking before we started recording that the regional tryouts for the 2026 Guardian Arena just opened up yesterday. So you've seen that kind of evolve from the very first one where to last year's at Patrick. So did it meet your expectations of what we wanted to do with Guardian Arena?
Yeah, again, in a lot of these ideas, I try to have really high expectations that are not very well defined. And then I find really motivated people to say, hey, can you fill all this in? Can you add all these details? Because I've got this idea, you know, when we wrote Competitive Endurance, the idea of our strategy for space superiority, and we have to operate in competition because we prefer that to crisis and conflict, but we have to be good at it. And I kept saying, we have to be good at competition. Do we have competition? Are we training people to be competitive, to think competitively? That was the initial grain of thought. And then it was, what do we have to be competitive about? Well, physically, we got to be ready to go. We got to be resilient. Are we going to do this as a team or are we going to do this as individuals? We're going to be a team.
Yeah.
Is it mental toughness or physical toughness? Yes.
Yeah, that's all right. That's right.
And so you create this idea of a competition, again, from the ground up, from the units, representing their deltas. And then they all come together for the finals. And it just been terrific to watch it grow. I turned it over to the Chiefs. I go, you guys got to fill the gaps in here. I got an idea, but you got to make this real. And I think the Chiefs really knocked it out of the park. And when you go out there and you watch this, I'll forever have the that mental image when there's that one team left to cross the line. You remember?
Yes.
And they're dragging the heaviest bag. I don't even know how they could stare at it without getting tired.
And this is at the very end.
The very end after 14 days, and they were dying.
Yes.
And everybody else was finished, and they had another 50 yards to drag this bag. And the entire, all the teams crowded around and were screaming at them. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, I definitely, you know, again, the individuals who have witnessed that have been so impressed. We talk about amplifying the Guardian spirit and just the teamwork and dedication, working together. And there's so many, you know, attributes, like leveraging the team, knowing your strength, knowing your weaknesses, mission planning it out. Like we've tried to incorporate a lot of those aspects that the competition really is a Guardian arena, because that's exactly what we're looking for in our Guardians, whether you're on the fields at Patrick or you're in the operations floor at Schriever, right? That same space-minded warfighter looking for bias for action is really, really important. And I think we definitely hit the nail on the head.
First speeches, I may have to check me on this. I think it was in the change of responsibility speech, November 22. I quoted Roosevelt. It's one of my favorites, the man in the arena.
Yeah.
And we all know that. And again, it's this idea that you're in the arena.
Yeah.
All eyes are on you, you know, and it's not the critics in the wings. It's not the people that are saying, you can't do this. It's the people that are there competing and trying to get it done. Those are the ones that count.
You know, under the umbrella of amplifying a Guardian spirit, I think, you know, when we talk about the functions of a service, the force development piece, I think, is really important and under there. And we've made a lot of headway on how do we develop the civilians, the enlisted, and the officers going forward. You know, OTC has been a huge success, I think. We're going through the planning of continue to evolve the enlisted education, and we're on training, and we're focused on how do we onboard civilians as Guardians, working through that. But we still, you know, a couple times when I'm with you, you get the question about do you want breadth or do you want depth? And just like you said, hey, on Guardian Arena, is it cognitive? Is it physical? Or are you saying yes? Right. So is it breadth? Is it subject matter depth that you want? you know, when we're talking about developing the force in the context of the space-minded warfighter under amplifying a guardian spirit?
You know, and the answer at the service level is, yeah, I want both.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's a fair desire at the service level. But I can't expect every single individual guardian to be broad and deep. Like, that's not going to be a success criteria. Do you have all the breadth you need and all the depth? That's not fair.
Yeah.
And I think this is where we go to the individual level, because we're small and we can, and see what people are good at. And you know those people that, boy, they are really deep. Now, they don't know anything else.
Yeah.
But, man, they can tell you everything there is to know about missile warning or this system or that system, and that, or they're engineers through and through. And that's what they love to do. And, well, let's take advantage of that. Let's amplify that spirit.
Yeah.
There's others that have broader perspectives. And, you know, one of the things I said at Guardian Field Forum when that question came up is, well, think about it as depth in other areas, right? You know, or experts in other areas, experts in multiple things at higher levels. Are you deep at joint planning? Are you deep at space integration rather than deep into a single weapon system or a single set of tactics or a single set of mission areas?
Yeah.
And so it's just about reframing that discussion. And as a service, we're going to need people that broadly understand how the Joint Force works, broadly understands communications and critical thinking and programming and budgets and like things that there's really not a career field for in the Space Force.
Yeah.
And we're going to need tactical pros that understand the weapon systems inside and out. So we need both as a service, but it's about how we develop individuals and take advantage of their strengths and weaknesses and track their competencies where we get that as a service.
Yeah, I think similar with you, I get, you know, emails or phone calls, or I bump into somebody, and there's always a request to have a guardian in an organization, on a staff, to help on a project. And when you think about the growth that we need to do as a service, and, you know, I if we can double the size, and when we say double the size, I mean, think about it, we're just about 11,000 uniform guardians now, you know, 15,000-16,000 with our civilian guardians. It's still smaller than Fort Bliss when we think about that. But to double the size, sir, you know, in addition to the weapon systems and operations centers, resiliency, do you see where the priority placing guardians in those organizations to be advocates and to be the integrators and the mission planners as we kind of navigate and weigh, right? Where do we put the talent, limited talent that we have to continue to grow the force?
I do. If you look at the Space Force truths that we wrote, number 6 is about that guardians are uniquely trained, educated, experiences for the space superiority mission, basically. And I think that's important. So we can publish doctrine documents and we can publish operating concepts, but there's nothing like putting a guardian on that joint staff or in the OSW staff or in the combatant command staff or in the service. It's the guardian that makes the difference.
Yeah.
And those guardians are going to have to be pretty broad. They're going to have to understand more than one mission area, right? If you're on the joint staff, you can't just say, I know everything there is to know about the countercom system.
That's right.
How can I help you? Well, you can't, right? You have to be broader than that. And so we're going to have guardians that can integrate and explain, advocate, and do mission planning for a broad set of responsibilities. And that's going to come with it. But you're going to need capacity to do that. Yeah. And that's why we have to grow.
Yeah. And this is the, you know, we talked earlier about the benefit of having a small service, but even doubling in size comparatively, right? It's still an advantage for us. But we have to continue to grow to do the things.
And if we get the processes sound.
Yeah.
Dealing with a small force and then make sure we don't lose that contact as we get a little bigger. I think we can hold on to the small mentality associated with taking care of our people and that sort of thing. 20,000 is not too small or not too large where we can't still apply that same small town concept.
That's right. We can't make sure we don't lose the benefit in the kind of connective tissue that we've grown in the last 6 years.
Exactly.
Speak about, you know, relationships and connective tissue. In the last scene that you put out on Line of Effort number 3 was partnering to win. And you've famously said, and I've borrowed this quote from you several times, that, you know, space is the ultimate team sport. And I have, you know, in aside, you know, with the industry and a joint force, but our coalition partners working with CSPO nations and all the other nations that we've had a chance to engage with that, you know, are looking to grow their nascent space capabilities and want to learn from our journey that we're on. I think that's been really successful, but you've been able to really see it firsthand and been super successful, right, in building those relationships across all aspects. And so just reflect a little bit on how successful, you know, where are we today, you think, with partnering to win and how important that is?
The idea for that line of effort came out of understanding that if we think we can do this all on our own, then we are going to naturally be limited in what the missions we're able to take on. But we don't build our spacecraft. We don't build our ground networks. Industry does that. We don't build our rockets. Industry does that. So we have to partner with them to make sure they're doing it the way we need it to do and it meets our operational challenges. The idea that parts of the Earth have a different vantage point of space, and we need to take advantage of our international partners because they look at the sky differently than we do.
That's right.
They're going to be able to collect data that we can't collect from the continental United States. So not to mention just some things require more capacity. And we'll never be able to buy all the capacity that we need, but we can certainly partner to increase our capacity. And so that's what I mean when I say it's the ultimate team sport. The last part of that, of course, is space, maybe unlike other domains, you can't just get out of the way if a war happens.
That's right.
I use the example of the Ukrainian airspace, you know, and if you look at a map of all the flights, you will see that commercial flights work around Ukraine because it's a pretty dangerous airspace to be flying through. Yeah. In space, if a war extends into space, you can't get out of the way. Orbital mechanics you're going to be right in the combat zone.
Yeah.
So therefore, since we all share the consequences, we all have to share the responsibilities. And it really does make it a team sport that we have to get right.
Yeah, I think you once said somewhere that, you know, on the Air Force side for just aviation across the Joint Force for air superiority, you know, if you shoot down an aircraft, it becomes an army problem.
That's right.
You know, not so much for us.
Yeah, the domain is kind of self-healing. It's self, it cleans itself because aircraft fall out of the sky and ships sink to the bottom of the ocean and the sea lanes are open once that's gone. In space, if you destroy a spacecraft, it's going to be in our domain for potentially a century.
Yeah.
If it's in the wrong orbit.
You know, you put out the commercial space strategy. And again, it was a completely different, I think, vantage point of perspective on how do you integrate, not only like latch, not like bolt on what industry can do, but operationally, right, bring industry in and make plans and decisions based on what we can partner with industry to do. Where have you seen the benefit of that philosophy? And because I think it's kind of a change from traditional thinking that we had.
Well, so it started with making sure we understood what is the appropriate role and functions of the government that the Space Force needs to hang on to versus what could we allow industry to perform for us? What could we buy as services as opposed to performing the function as a government entity? We haven't had to ask those questions for a service in a long time. You know, we kind of sorted it out in the Air Force, and certainly centuries of experience in the Navy and the Army have allowed them to figure out what's appropriate for the government to do and what can they let industry do for services. We just didn't have that experience. And so I think the idea first and foremost was clearly define what our missions are, where we're looking for help, what we think is appropriate for industry, and then prioritize those. Here's where we need help because we are low on capacity or there's a gap to fill.
Yeah.
And I've gotten good feedback from industry that's helpful. It helps them prioritize their resourcing.
Yeah, you know, when I think about the development, you know, going a little bit back to amplifying the Guardian spirit and what are the opportunities that we provide Guardians, and we talked about education with industry and fellowships, and right, how do we close any of those seams and gaps that maybe we're having with industry specifically is really important. And that's something, at least from my office, that I'm continually challenging the team and say, hey, what are the experiences and the opportunities that we can give Guardians and partner and take advantage of, right? Some of the technology and some of the processes, some of the operations centers, right? Or cybersecurity systems, right? That industry has to say, hey, let's send a Guardian over there and learn from industry and then have them come back and help us maybe fix a pain point, or at least strengthen that relationship as we go. And I think it's a great opportunity and a philosophy for a service to have where we're going.
Well, the technology is changing so fast. The industry is changing so fast. We would be woefully out of date if we didn't do that. We have to deploy our guardians into industry where the leading edge of technology is unfolding. If you're a tank commander in the Army, maybe the commercial market doesn't have as much to offer you because you're not going to move as fast away from what you do inside the service. Yeah. But that's just not true in space right now. And we've got to stay out there on the leading edge of the technology.
Yeah. You know, the other part with the partnering to win and with industry specifically, even academia, but our PMA, right, the full-time, part-time guardians. And we've had several conversations about, you know, just the single component model. And I think that's another great opportunity for partnership with, you know, where do we, you know, where part-time guardians want an opportunity to go out to academia and maybe teach or work in industry or in another organization, but they're still part of the guardian team. It's not a separate component to be able to do that. I think as we work that out, as we, you know, continue to bring more and more part-time guardians on, I think we did our first couple last month. I think, sir, that's going to be another, you know, great way to build, strengthen that partnership with all the other entities that, you know, we need in order to, you know, team sport for space superiority.
Several hundred part-time positions.
Yeah.
In any other service, that would be rounding error.
Yeah.
For us, that's a big chunk of our formations.
It is.
Which means that because they're part-time guardians, they're going to be full-time something else. Mm-hmm. And we're going to hire people that bring full-time something else in that's value added to us. And they're going to bring that experience. They're going to bring that expertise. And then they're going to be a part of our formations. Even if it's on a part-time basis, we're going to benefit from those. And I think it's a very valuable model, I think, for us going forward.
Yeah, I'm excited, you know, as we continue to implement that and see the advantages that we have on both sides as we go through it. Well, sir, I think we're coming a little running to the end of our opportunity to sit here.
Let's
and
just
chat.
Stay here. Come on. Let's just keep
I know,
talking.
Right? This is fun.
Otherwise, we got to go back to work.
I know. I think there's an L2 meeting you have to go to.
I'm sure there is.
Sir, you know, 35 years, you know, we talked about a lot of the amazing lines of effort and everything that you were able to accomplish, right, while you were here. You know, looking back now, if you were to go back and give, you know, Lieutenant Saltzman with his history major, you know, coming into this business and, you know, starting out in the military, what advice would you give?
Well, I wouldn't try to talk to that kid. He was hard-headed and not worth the time and energy. But for young people coming into the service now, I think I would offer, don't get too enamored with a particular pathway to success. It's one thing to say there's a career path. It's another to be beholden to a certain set of things that you feel like you have to do or you're not going to be successful. I think if anybody could learn from me, I'm a service chief and there was no real definite path. I was an ICBM operator for 4 years, never to do that again. I went to the NRO, failed that twice, kept coming back. The first time I was in an operational system for space was as the group commander at Buckley.
Yeah, I remember that. Yep.
So I think it's don't get too enamored with any particular paths. I think it's have a good time because it's the journey, not the destination.
Yeah.
Get to know the people around you. They're amazing. And then seek challenges. I've told the story before that some of the best career advice I get is when people tell me not to do things because then all I want to do is whatever it is they told me not to do. You know, should I go to the weapons school? Absolutely not. That'll ruin your career. All right, I'm in.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, where should I go to war college? Oh, you should go to National War College. Okay, I'm going to Harvard. Like whatever the advice was, I felt like, you know, the challenge was somewhere else. And so find the challenge, find the toughest job you can do. Yeah. Do a great job at it, and things kind of work out. That's what I would say.
That's great advice. That's great advice. So, any sneak peek into what's next on the Saltzman's journey? You and Jennifer, have you thought about?
Yeah, we're gonna
other than maybe taking a break.
We'll take a little bit of a break. We'll go back to Kentucky, our hometown. We're from the same hometown, so we'll go back there. Look, this gets in your blood. I'm not leaving. I'm going to contribute however the Space Force needs me to contribute for as long as it'll be useful to them.
Yeah.
It'll be in a different capacity, you know, and I'll try to help industry. I'll try to help policymakers. I'll try to help anybody that needs anything I learned along the way. I'll be there to contribute, but it'll definitely be from the outside looking in, cheering on all the way.
That's right.
But from the outside looking in.
Well, I appreciate it. So, you know, hopefully, I think we talked earlier about, you know, maybe this will be the episode that has the highest, you know, listening
if
ratings.
If it's not, it's probably your fault.
I think it is.
I'm going to hold you responsible if we're not the highest rated show.
But assuming, sir, the thousands of guardians and listeners that we're going to have, any parting words of wisdom or anything you want to mic with?
One of the things that I keep getting asked is, do you have any regrets? And in all honesty, it's not because I've done everything right. It's because it's not useful. Having regrets, we're going to make mistakes. The key is, are we moving forward? Yeah. And I think as long as we continue to think we are building something that matters, and tomorrow's going to be better than today because we're going to make it a little better. Yeah. Find the challenges, test the assumptions, come up with answers, and move out. You know, and I think that's what I see. That's that guardian spirit that's out there. I think we've done a pretty good job of laying the initial bricks of the foundation. I think there's some solid things to build on. And now it's just about that mindset to keep building, keep making things better, take advantage of that guardian spirit.
Well, sir, thank you very much for everything. Thanks for, you know, giving Kathy and I this opportunity to serve along you and Miss Jennifer these last couple of years.
Well, thanks for being a great team.
Thanks for your 35 years of service, and I wish you the best of luck in retirement. I hope to see you again soon, sir.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, listeners, thanks for tuning in and listening to the Perigee Podcast, and I will talk to you again soon out here. For those of you who are still watching, we have kind of like the after credits snapshot of a few little more things we're going to do today. Kind of like the Marvel after the movie. There's always that little outtake. So we're going to do that. So sir, the team wanted to kind of show you something, surprise you.
Okay.
With a little thank you, if you will. We know that you're a big fan of several franchises. And apparently there are several franchises who are big fans of you. So we reached out and a couple of people wanted to maybe say hello or thank you to you. So
right.
I'm going to grab this iPad. So now, sir, you're on camera. So they're going to listen to what you say and their reaction, and they're going to see your facial expression. So,
okay.
So let's see. Now they trained me on this. I was signed off on my, put this up. Okay, sir. So you're just going to go up and hit play.
Hey, how you doing, General Saltzman? This is Bijan Robinson here, man. And hey, I just want to say congratulations on retirement and 35 years of service. That's amazing. That's such a blessing. And, you know, God is so good. But, hey, man, I hope you and Jennifer have this amazing next phase of life and that you guys just really just enjoy the fruits of each other and the fruits of everybody that supports you and, you know, all of us at the Falcons that who support you. So I know you guys say semper supra, but we say rise up. And hey, it's just two models that just go together perfectly and that just sound amazing together. So, hey, man, I just want to say thank you for all your service and thank you for all you do. And I hope you have a great one and hope to see you soon, maybe at a game or something. But stay blessed and rise up, man.
Awesome. All right, sir. So I'm going to stop this real quick.
What a great running back, huh? This is the year.
So he invited you to a game. So that is on camera. He said, come out to a game.
Love it.
So I'm going to do that.
I'm going to be there.
Now, okay, so, sir, you know, from Bowling Green.
Yeah.
Right? Went to school in Boston.
True.
Atlanta Falcons fan.
That's right. It's tough.
Yeah.
When I grew up, there were three channels on television. So for all you Guardians out there that struggle to find something to watch on TV.
That's right now.
Yeah. There were three channels. And so on Sundays, you could either watch the AFC on one channel or the NFC on the other, and you got regional coverage. So I either watched the Bengals or I watched the Falcons. And so I fell in love with the Falcons in the 70s and have been a fan ever since. So that Super Bowl with the Patriots was one of the low points of my personal adult life. But we will soldier on. And now we got players like Bijan Robinson. We're going to be in good shape. So,
but that's what people are so passionate about sports, because you never know.
You never know.
Right? Just like in
look,
space.
Nothing makes you more resilient than watching your team lose.
You never know what's going to happen
that's
in the future.
Exactly right.
So, yeah. All right, sir. So we have another individual who wanted to kind of say a little something to you.
Oh, geez.
Hey, Chance, what's going on? This is Big Papi, David Ortiz. I just want to tell you congratulations. 35 years in the military, man, that is awesome. Thank you for the service. Thank you for everything that you have done for our country. God bless you and enjoy retirement.
Awesome. Big Papi.
Yeah.
Hero of mine.
And from Boston, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I
am a Falcons fan, but Red Sox. Like live and die by the Red Sox.
Yeah.
So going to school there, my first apartment was three blocks from Fenway Park, and as a cadet, I got the little red reserve ID card. When you're a cadet, you get a reserve ID card. Not anymore. See, all the good benefits are gone. So I got a reserve ID card, and you could get in for $5 to the games if you showed your reserve ID card. So I grew up kind of watching the Red Sox and fell in love with them. So
a lot of your developmental years.
Yes.
They're watching Boston.
Were formed in Fenway Park. And so again, you had to be resilient in those days. But now, thanks to Big Pop, we've got a couple of World Series wins under our belt.
Well, sir, just as you said that you've been watching from afar some of your heroes and
that's awesome.
People making a difference, they've been watching you.
That's humbling.
They wanted to say thanks.
That's very humbling.
So, all right, sir. Well, again, thanks a lot. I really do appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thanks.